Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. It's officially a new year, but we're still not over how great our podcast turned out in 2017. I've been sifting through all of the 50-plus interviews we did to find the best advice from some of the year's most notable names in independent film. Last week, in our first volume of Best Of, we heard from Flying Lotus, Julian Robespierre, Brett Gelman, and more. Today, you'll hear selections from Sean Baker, Ruben Ostlund, Lloyd Kaufman of Troma, and Parker Smith. That last name may not be as familiar as the rest. Parker Smith is the director of the South by Southwest standout Ramblin' Freak. His movie is essentially a documentary about a cross-country road trip he took from Austin to NYC with his cat, to find a bodybuilder who took so many steroids that his arms actually physically exploded. But it is also a story about him coming to terms with his twin sister's death, and a study on the disease that killed them. The most impressive part of the documentary, however, is that Smith did every aspect of production completely by himself. This clip is from an episode called How to Make a Movie Entirely on Your Own.
I lived in Boulder in high school, and for my senior year, and so I just sort of went to see you because it was a film program and it was the only place I applied. And then you get there, and at the orientation, you've already paid your first semester's shit, and they're just like, by the way, this is what he said. He's like, this is not like an authentic film school. This is very experimental. He's like, hardly anybody comes out of this thing and gets a job.
Weird.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. And we're sitting there, we're like, what?
Yeah.
And then they sort of, I mean, I'm not angry or anything about it, but I did feel like they were sort of, trying to, all these kids come to school because they love movies, movies, and they want to go make movies, and they teach you like, no, those are bad. Mm. Movies are not good. Like, you want to make, art. You want to glue butterfly wings to 16 millimeter film, And so I did two semesters of filmmaking. I was there for 4 years, but I dropped out three different times. So I did Super 8 and I did 16 millimeter, so I can go edit on a Steam Deck, but that's not going to get me like a job anywhere.
Right.
And then they would say, well, the third and fourth classes of those, the later semesters, the later years are more like professional stuff where you can learn how a microphone works and stuff like that.
Like digital sort of.
Yeah. I didn't
software.
Make it that far.
Okay.
So, the movie, that I just made is only like the second thing I ever made with sound. And the first thing I made was my intern video for when I moved here for the Film Society. Like, I made, I had to learn how to, like, level mics and stuff making the movie.
Yeah. So I guess that's a good segue into this question that I had about what exactly did you learn while in the process of making this movie as far as, technical sort of film stuff and, like, DIY setups and...
Yeah, I mean... I think the shots slowly get better as the film goes on.
Yeah, totally.
Because I learned like, oh, this camera looks really cool if you like let it blow out in the windows or if you like, like how to make the DV look nice, like what looks better and what looks like garbage. I still don't exactly know how to color balance it. The auto feature was nice. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because we had a colorist come in after the fact and she was like, she went made everything match. And I was like, no. Like these two cameras don't even match themselves. Cause like one's, much older. So the heads are worn down on the tape and you don't match them. Don't make things, if things look tungsteny, like leave them like that. Like that's how it's supposed to be. Like they were trying to crossfade, the audios and stuff on the edits. I'm like, no, leave those clunky and sharp. Like people were trying to like make it look like more professional, more like polished, but, gave myself like a lot of, wiggle room by like the movie is about a guy who doesn't know how to make a movie.
Yeah.
So
it's just really interesting. Like you say, it's, your technique gets better as the movie goes on. So it really is like,
it never gets great. Don't.
No. The story itself is fantastic. But the technique and the look aids the story in that sense. But that process, watching you sort of learn and seeing it happen is a really, I think, another part of the story that we get from the film. Mm-hmm. So you had this set up in the car, did you have cameras positioned in the very beginning?
It didn't make it into the film, but there was I like, I had the two dash cams, one on the road and one inside the car. And then I had, I took off the headrest of my passenger seat and I mounted a camera with a GorillaPod to that. And so I have lots of shots of me like driving with one hand, like, you know, moving the camera around and like, you know, trying to like drive while shooting. I'm surprised I didn't die.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. Well.
In your case, it really shows that you were the only one on this film.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that experience a little bit?
So I tried to make a short with my friends Ryan Dyke and Jane Urban. We're trying to make a short that I'd written. And I just sort of felt like I couldn't, me personally, I couldn't like figure out how to work with a crew because everything I did in college was by myself. Hmm. I couldn't figure out how to like speak to them and like to help them to get me to do what I was trying to do. Though Ryan says, you know, that I could, but I didn't feel like I was able to direct a film. I couldn't control all the moving parts or something. I couldn't figure out how to get the actor to do what I wanted him to do. So I was like, well, I'm just going to cut out everybody and just sort of, you know, I can only be responsible for myself and the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the cat is there to like make you know that like it is a documentary because like I can't control the cat. He's a, you know, it's not a dog.
Well, he is like a character. It's almost like, I mean, it's almost like a buddy road trip film, you know?
Yeah. Like a guy with no friends.
How much did you like sort of budget yourself for your equipment?
I have this receipt paper at home, from when I was at work on break. I was like, did a budget, like, you know, I'm like $100 for a mic, $100 for this. And then I looked at it recently and the math is all wrong. Like, I didn't know. I worked one guy at my job. I sell tacos. Yeah. One guy quit one day and all of a sudden there was a bunch of hours that needed to be covered. And so I worked like 110 hours in 2 weeks and I got like a really nice paycheck and then I just dumped it all and stuff. I was like, what do I need? Like, you know, I was like, I need two shotgun mics. I need some cables. I need some tripods. I bought some, you know, dead cats. I never used them. I never used those, but I was just like, well, you know, what do people to make films buy?
Yeah. How did you go about tracking down what you needed?
eBay for the cameras. Mm-hmm. You know, I bought the one with Greg and then I had to buy the same one again.
So you had two, how many cameras did you have total?
Two of the DVX and then two dash cams. Mm-hmm. Apparently there's no like American market for dash cams. So you gotta buy them all from China.
Huh?
So I found some that had, LCD screens so I could see the shot, which not all of them have. And then I was like leaving like, you know, Friday and they were held up at customs. They weren't coming. Hmm. And so I was like, well, I might just have to omit the whole part of the film, which is going to ruin the dash cam car crashes thing. I was like, that was a big part of it. But they came. They were pieces of crap. They like you know, you'll notice like halfway through the film they stopped appearing because they stopped working. You know. But the audio is nice. Like the audio, we used the audio in the film, like it worked well enough.
What did you use for the audio? Just two shotgun mics?
Two shotgun mics, like, yeah.
On the
thing. You know, so there's some they didn't even have like a nice mount, had like some old mounts that there's some occasional like popping and stuff that happens, but I think it works.
Mm-hmm.
So I had those two. I bought the two GorillaPods, the big ones with the nice ball heads. Those are awesome. I bought two real tripods that I'd never even used.
Okay. Well, it's good to be prepared.
Yeah. I was just like, I don't know what I need. I'm just going to buy everything.
Yeah.
So microphones, cameras, tripods. I bought an LED light.
Yeah, lights.
I want to know just a little hot shoe.
Just one?
Yeah.
Not like a panel or anything? Just like a little...
Like a little LED like panel the size of like, you know... Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever used that either.
Okay.
You know, I just, bought everything I thought I might need and then I was broke and I, had to go and get a credit card to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go buy a van.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. The van. So I call Greg on, in the first scene on like the 16th of September,
mm-hmm.
2 days later is my birthday, the 18th of September. And I'm like going out to, the other side of Texas, which is a big state.
Yeah.
To make a music video in my van with 200,000 miles, that was going to be the whole point of the film, and it broke down in the middle of nowhere, and I left it in the desert. We got back, this family was coming there, and they picked us up in their RV because they had left it behind in a similar situation.
Hmm.
And we rode back with them, and they were like, they were their own movie for sure. They could have been.
Yeah.
And so I had to go buy a new van. I was like, I was attached to the Honda Odyssey for the vehicle. That was where the idea came from. And so I went to the credit union. I got like a loan for, which was like, at the time, I was like, this is the most adult thing I've ever done by far. You know, I'm going to go buy a van by myself. Like, I don't have, I need like a co-signer? No, like, I'm just going to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think I accidentally, like, became an adult making this movie.
So then how did you go about getting this thing produced?
Instagram.
Instagram?
You know, I'm not, like, super savvy on that. Somehow it just happened. I was, like, you know, I was trying to edit the Public Access Studio. They have a nice thing down there. Like, you know, you can, they'll teach you how to use the equipment and they'll give it to you as long as you give them something to make out of it, you know?
Okay.
So I was down there trying to edit and it was never going to happen because it was just such a slow process. And then, like, they were only open for like 6 hours a night on like 4 nights a week. It was mm-hmm. never going to get finished. And so I started like reaching out to people. Like, I was trying to find, you know, like, I emailed Vincent Gallo. He didn't reply. Met some people in town. Didn't like them. They didn't like me. I don't think it didn't go well. And then one day I was in my bedroom drinking, and I taped my cell phone to my ceiling fan, and I turned it on some motion,
mm-hmm.
and I posted it on Instagram. And then somehow this guy Glenn Zipper liked the video, even though I don't even hashtag or anything. I'm not even sure how he found it. He liked it, and he liked some of my other stuff. And then he followed me, and I was like, "Hey, look at this trailer. Like, what do you think? Like." You know, he's like, "Well, when is it, you know, do you have something I can see? Do you have the film?" I'm like, "No, no." Like, this trailer is the first thing I've done with it. And it took me like, you know, 5 months to even get this much done. He's like, "Well, how about this? I'll send you a computer and you can edit on it at home. And then in return, I'll be your producer." And I was just like, maybe,
yeah.
You know, maybe. Like, I was like, I didn't really know who he was or even what that meant. I was like, "What does that producer do?"
Yeah.
And he's like, "Well, we do everything else that you don't want to do." I'm mm-hmm. like, "All right, that sounds great." Which is true. Like, you know, there's like filmmaking, you can all the camera and stuff, and then everything else that you still have to do yourself up until that point. And so, and then I sent him like 30 minutes of like uncut footage, mm-hmm. like an idiot. Like, he sent me the computer and I was like, "Hey, check out this raw footage. Like, you're going to love it."
Yeah.
He was like, "This is, you know, I'm not," he said, quote, "I'm going to have to spin this." I'm like, "No, you're not." Like, and, so that, you know, sort of cooled him off a little bit on the project. And then I went and I edited for like, you know, four or five months. I took out a loan from the same bank that gave me the car to pay myself for a month and a half to edit full time.
Cool.
I'm still paying that off. It was like a personal loan. Like, it was like a 14% interest rate or some ridiculous thing.
Damn.
Which I know what that means now. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. That's high. It's very high. Yeah, and I just, like, stayed in my room for several months and just worked all the time. And then, you know, a week before South by deadline, I sent them a 2.5 hour long cut. Mm-hmm. And they were like, "Well, this is nice. It's too long. Mm-hmm. We're going to get you an extension, and we're going to get it down to, like, you know, more manageable time." And we did, like, an hour and a half now.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. It was 3.5 hours of, you know.
Well, it's a lot of footage.
Yeah, it's a lot of footage. And it's mostly just a guy driving, you know. The movie is the brown bunny with, like, a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And no blowjob, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. Sorry, yeah. Guys. If you're looking for blowjobs, this is not the film for you. Uh-huh. Now that you've made your first feature, you know, you just said it was nice because you had some time to relax.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel? Like, was it the cathartic sort of moment or experience that you
totally
wanted?
I was at this interview, and they were like, "What was the most exciting part of the journey?" And I was like, "There's nothing exciting on the journey. Like, it was miserable."
Mm-hmm.
So the most exciting part was getting to South By, you know?
Yeah,
like, the catharsis came, I guess. There's not necessarily any catharsis in the film, maybe a little bit at the end, but, like, it really came in reality, like, I think yesterday.
Okay. You know? All right.
Yeah,
at the premiere, right?
Yeah. It was wild. You know, people want to interview me and talk to me and stuff. It's crazy. I was, you know, selling tacos. I was delivering tacos. I had to be there at 5 a.m. yesterday.
Yeah.
Delivering tacos downtown. And I, you know, clocked out at 1. And then I went to the premiere at 3:45. It's a trip.
Do you have any advice if you had a best piece of advice for anyone who's trying to make a movie?
Yeah. This is like when I was interning, one of the programmers at AFS, Lars Nielsen, he's like, "So what are you in Austin for?" I was like, "Well, I want to make movies." He's like, "Well, are you making movies?" And I was like, "No." He's like, "Well, that's not how you do it." Like, he's like, "You should go buy a camera and you should go make documentaries."
Mm.
He's like, "You know, learn how it works and, like, learn how to tell a story and then do that." And that is what I did.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here right now. It's like, I bought a camera and I went out and I made a movie.
Yeah.
Go outside and, you know, make a documentary about somebody. Like, it's you can do it by yourself. You know, you don't need a crew. If you want to make a narrative, you know, thing with actors and stuff, that's harder. I don't have any advice for you.
Yeah.
You know, I failed at that, but hopefully I'll learn at some point. Yeah, just go outside and do it.
Next up is my favorite interview of the year, nay, perhaps even my favorite experience in my 2 years with no film school. I got the chance to sit down with Sean Baker after seeing The Florida Project at the New York Film Festival. The Florida Project is not only my favorite film of the year, it is the culmination of decades of hard work. Baker had made 5 movies prior to The Florida Project, the majority of which came without any financial backing. He is a DIY filmmaker in its purest form. This clip is from an episode called The Florida Project, Sean Baker on why you need to invest in yourself when no one else will. You went to film school, right?
I did. Yeah. NYU.
NYU.
Tisch. Cool. Undergrad.
Yeah. Very cool. For undergrad, though.
Yes, yes.
And what kind of things were you learning? When was that?
Oh, you really?
Yeah, sorry.
A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
No, a very long time ago, actually. I graduated. I'm not going to say a year, but let's just say I graduated with like Todd Phillips, Mark Forster, those guys.
Okay, that works for me.
Yeah, yeah.
What were some of the things that you took away from film school back then?
That when I first was leaving film school, I realized that it was way more about the people you were meeting there than the education you were receiving.
Right.
Equipment was very important, the access to equipment at the time. And I started to think, I could have done this at my community college. And I kind of still think that way.
Yeah.
Hope NYU isn't listening. I think it's all about the people you are working with. So I always told people, hey, it doesn't matter if you're going to school or not, as long as you just go hang out with the people mm-hmm. who are actually going and get on their crews, you know, and learn that way. Because that's exactly what you're doing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you're learning from working together and forming relationships that you will be hopefully, and in my case, yes, it did work out, you'll have for the rest of your life. NYU is more about my time to be in such a wonderful city that provided me with ways of almost self-educating.
Right.
So I had the retrospective theaters, I had Anthology Film Archives, that was major in my life. I had the Film Society of Lincoln Center with all the wonderful festivals. I had Kim's Video.
R.I.P.
Yeah, all of them. So it was a great time to be in New York because you just had right now is a great time too.
Okay.
Like there was a moment in there where it got a little hairy.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, like I live in L.A. now and I look at all like these amazing theaters, Nighthawk and Metrograph and the Quad is now amazing. So I look at, like, I'm jealous.
Yeah. You bring up L.A. now and mm-hmm. one of the things that you said at that screening the talk, yeah. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
Is you said that once you hit L.A., you kind of don't look back in terms of you lived in New York City. You still have an apartment in New York City,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but – yeah, because it's rent stabilized. I sublet it out. But L.A. does – there's no doubt about it. It puts you in the world of the industry.
Okay.
Now, look, you can have an independent film career here, obviously. Look at Spike Lee and Jarmusch, and you know it works here. It totally works here. But there was the proximity for me helped me out. I think I don't know whether it was the time in my life or the fact that I actually felt myself closer to, you know, colleagues and peers that were working in my field, and I wanted to, you know, I felt almost like a stronger sense of community there. And not slamming the New York's film community. I'm just saying that that was the time where I felt like I was finally interacting with other filmmakers. And so I found inspiration there.
When do you think would be a good time for an aspiring filmmaker to move to LA? Does he have to have like an established feature out? Does it make?
No, I think it really depends on what sort of work you want to do. Mm-hmm. And and yeah, and your career path that you want to take. I mean, look at all the filmmakers who live in Austin now. Right. I mean, they're obviously doing great, and they have a sense of community there. And so it really depends. I mean, look, if you want to go right into TV, and you have, or studio films, obviously, you go there fast. You know, I never had that desire, and so even living there now is more about quality of life. You know, my income level is still, it's just an independent filmmaker, so it actually is cheaper to live there.
Yeah.
And also being in the unions, it helps out. I'm very close to the DGA, and there's lots of, you know, for me, it provides me with a lot of events and screenings, and so I don't know. It really, really comes down to your career path. And yeah.
Well, I'm like, I say this just, you know, considering making a move out there myself. I don't know anyone out there really. Mm. Yeah. But I think, you know, like you say, it's about, I guess, the relationships that you'll forge there. Do you have to have relationships in place, or did you find it easy to sort of like make new relationships?
I did find it easy to make new relationships. I mean, you have people who are all struggling. They're trying to break in. So you're surrounding yourself with other people who are like-minded. Mm-hmm. And there does seem to be, you know, to a certain degree, a social, you know, uprising there, where I see that there are more events for filmmakers. You have Film Independent out there. It's very strong. I mean, I know, you know, IFP is here, and it's the same sort of thing. If you're going down the route of an agency, you want to find an agent, and you're going to be working within the system. Mm-hmm. If you're there, you're getting way more meetings. You can find financiers and producers easier. Mm-hmm. So there's that to take into consideration. I was lucky enough to land a job. It was a very, you know, it was just one of those, like, right out of school, finding a small publishing company that put me in charge of their AV work. So basically, I was producing a lot of corporate type videos. I was interviewing authors, traveling all over the states just to interview them, and then put together a little EPK, right? But that's good. That's good work. I mean, it pays the bills. And I would suggest anybody who is striving to become a filmmaker to stay within your, at least in the AV world, because you're practicing on a daily basis. And mm-hmm. even though it feels like, oh, this isn't me being creative, it is. It really is, because you're still framing shots. You're still editing. You're still getting, you know, understanding the technical side of things. So, and trust me, I've gone to places where I've even spent how long? About 6 months editing and shooting wedding videos. I mean, what felt like the lowest part of my, like, I can't get any lower. I'm doing wedding videos. But that, looking back on it, even though at the time I was just like, this is really, I can't get any lower. Looking back, it was actually a time in which there was a lot of growth. I was spending the time to edit these wedding videos in a way that was like, I was putting my heart into them.
Yeah.
You know, and not only that, I was actually getting to, in a sociological way, I was going to all these weddings from people from different backgrounds. And I even wrote a script that hasn't been produced yet, but was about a Russian wedding, because of the amount of, you know, you live in New York, and of, like, the weddings that I had to go out in Brighton Beach. Yeah. And they were so unique and so wonderful, so fun and so full of character that, like, as somebody who's a writer, it was giving me so much material. So at the time, yes, wanted to kill myself. And you know, looking back in hindsight, I actually got a lot from it. So sticking in the world of, you know, in this industry to a certain degree, I think that going off and, you know, and being doing something outside of your industry, is, if you can you know, if you can find, if you can pay the bills with doing corporate videos or editing or whatever you can, I would say do that over doing something completely unrelated, because there's still, it's still practice. You're still, and again, I'm the type of filmmaker who thinks that a director should know almost all aspects of technology, of you know, the technological aspects of filmmaking. I really feel like a director should know how to turn on a freaking camera. I've met too many directors who can't even turn on a camera, which is embarrassing. You know, I think that a director should understand shooting, not be a master DP. No, obviously not. But know how to capture an image. You know, should know how to edit on one of the nonlinear systems. You should know Final Cut, or you should know the Avid. You know, because what it comes down to is that this is a director-driven art, right? I mean, one person, eventually it falls into a director's lap, and you should be able to, you know, jump on these, whatever these, the editing system or the camera or whatever it takes to actually. It's like a painter not knowing how to pick up a brush.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I totally went off on a tangent.
No, that was great. I mean, it's even more a thing to know every aspect of production if you're working on your first passion project.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know?
Because people are, you can't expect everyone to ever have the amount of passion you'll have for that. They're not being paid enough.
Yeah.
You know, they're simply, you can't even, I mean, there are, of course, those really special personalities out there, those producers who are with you no matter what, but it's asking a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because the amount, when you break down the, when you really break it down and you're saying like, how much did I actually make making this feature? It's usually, well, if you're not paying for it, if you're paying for it yourself, you're usually losing money.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even in the sense that, even in a place where you're getting like your director's minimums from the union. So I get, say I just am a director and I have a DGA minimum coming in for a feature.
Right.
Okay. You break that down over 3 years of time and you are working almost like 6 days a week and it's 12 hours a day sometimes, you're basically making minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's more than that too, because you're constantly thinking about these things. So
the amount of stress, you're killing yourself. There's that whole effect too.
So become a filmmaker.
Yeah. But ultimately though, then you look at it and you're like, okay, but I am in the position, you have to stay positive because like you're in a position in which, wow, you actually are able to work in this art form. It's the most expensive art form. It takes a lot of luck and a lot of right timing and a lot of like, you know, years and years of being driven and ultimately it's like, you know, but I'm in a place of privilege. I'm being able to do this, and this is really something that I should be thankful for, because, you know, so many people are not in that position. They are going through, they have jobs that they can't wait until 5 p.m. They just want to go home and forget about it. We go home, we don't go home. Sometimes our, you know, we live with our work for 3 years straight, and then it's on to the next one, you know? And so these are our babies, these are our children. And so if you think about it, it's like we are like career long parents. That's our thing, you know? It's weird. It's crazy.
Yeah.
By that time, because I think of what happened with Takeout and Prince of Broadway, we were able to get financing finally. And then all of a sudden Dree Hemingway comes my way because of her manager loving Prince of Broadway. So it proved that like all that, like me putting my own money into it and like, will I ever get a break? Yes. In hindsight, it actually did work. Like all my self investment in my own projects actually got me to a place where suddenly, finally I had a financier. Finally I had a Mariel's daughter, Ernest's great granddaughter starring in my film. And you know, it was just finally the ball was rolling. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm going to sum up that led to Duplass and loving, you know, coming up to the next film. And then of course, Tangerine leading to this film. So it was like, it was years of just like a lot of, almost giving up, but feeling that if I don't invest in myself, nobody will.
Yeah.
And I think that if anything is my, is what I say to like people. You just got to keep going and putting your product out there, because you got to keep proving yourself. You're not, people aren't just going to come and just throw money at you until they see actually potential and, you know, yeah. So yeah, I'm sorry for being so long winded there.
No, are you kidding me? I mean, it just seems like, you know, you, if no one else is going to believe in you, you have to believe in yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I do have a really great team around me, and they've been very supportive over the years, and I've loved collaborating with them. So you, it's also about finding, you know, those people that you really connect with and have a similar sensibility, and people that you can, yeah, again, rely on.
Yeah. Yeah. The Kaufmans are a very impressive family. Dad is Lloyd Kaufman, creator of The Toxic Avenger and King of B-Movies, whose independent studio Troma Entertainment has produced and distributed more than 1,000 films and launched the careers of major directors like Guardians of the Galaxy's James Gunn, who wrote the company's cult classic Romeo and Juliet in 1996. Mom is Pat Swinney Kaufman, who was the deputy film commissioner for New York State for 20 years, where she built the state's tax credit program for movie productions and was called one of the most powerful women in the U.S. film industry by Variety magazine. Their daughter is Lizbeth Kaufman, co-founder of Kitsplit, which is now the biggest online camera rental company. Liz Nord sat down with all of them for an interview titled "The First Family of DIY on How to Make Your Own Damn Movie." Here it is.
You know, in thinking about you coming here, I thought, this is the first family of DIY. You know, this is the first family of independent film. And I'm wondering what that kind of means to you. What does the do-it-yourself ethos mean? How does it play into what you've done in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, Daddy, you've written books on this.
Well, I made the mistake of going to Yale University. I got room with a movie nut, and the Film Society, which he ran, had a big stack of Cahiers du Cinéma magazines in French, and I speak French. And that is the magazine of the French Cinematheque. And they propounded the auteur theory of filmmaking, which says the director should be 100% in control and the film should express his, her, or its heart and soul. I bought into that and stupidly decided to stay in New York and be in the underground and just didn't matter. Just make the film. Make your own damn movie. Make your own damn movie. And luckily, the commissioner permitted me to do that for many years, and also was a big, I think the 20 years that the commissioner gave to New York State was very nice for students, because the other commissioners very often don't talk to the students and don't talk to the traumas of the world. Mm-hmm. And Pat Swinney Kaufman was as nice to the NYU or the make your own damn movie student as she was to Spider-Man.
I mean, I think one of the great things about having our lives and careers be in New York and raising Elizabeth and her two sisters in New York was that we were just completely immersed in the independent film world of New York. I mean, my work, I worked with the big studios, the big television productions, the big films, but I also very much worked with all the independents, as Lloyd has very generously said, because I really did view New York as the independent film capital of the world. And have always been amazed at the opportunity that I think exists in New York uniquely. And I think that one of the great things about what Lizbeth now does is that it fits so perfectly in that universe. It really is going to make it even more convenient and even easier for the independent filmmaker, young or old, to find his or her way, get the equipment that he or she needs, and do the project that they want.
Kitsplit is perfect for this new age of micro-budget. Everyone can make a movie. The making of cinema has been democratized. It's terrific. You can make a film for virtually no money, and it can be great. We're producing a couple of films now with new young directors. One, Heidi Moore in Indiana, and one a guy in Portugal, Fernando, whatever his name is, who made Banana Mother Effers, a very funny trauma movie. And look at everyone can make a movie. You don't need Rupert Murdoch. You don't need Summer Meyerson. You can do it yourself.
And my dad has also written a series of books called Make Your Own Damn Movie, which now we all say as a, right. as a normal
you
phrase.
Have to say and it our, like, make your own damn movie. Make your own damn movie. Sell your own damn movie.
But you're a big proponent of the idea that, you know, you don't have to go to film school. You don't need a big Hollywood budget. If you've got an idea, a vision, and passion and dedication, that you can make an amazing project.
Because you each have, you know, experience starting initiatives, starting companies and films and projects, doing a startup right now, what advice do you have, persistence being part of it, what advice do you have for anyone just trying to start from scratch? Because almost all of our listeners are starting something from scratch, whether it's a script or a production or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'm totally, I feel like I'm in awe of filmmakers because every time you make a new film, it's like starting a new company and you have to figure so much out from insurance to hiring and all of that. And it happens every time. So yeah, people have a lot of work there. I guess advice, I think for me, staying very open-minded and collaborative, treating the process of starting something as a team process.
I think to build on what Lisbeth just said, I know that Lloyd's going to say, just do it, right? To thine own self be true, just do it. And he can speak very eloquently about that. And I would say that when you are just starting out, to find your community, to network as much as possible, go to every possible event and network and find other people who are like you, delving into this industry and meet people at all different levels, right? Those who've already have a project or two under their belt, to those that are just, you know, putting their toe in the water. Just meet people at every single level and connect, network, and build your community and build your entourage, because together you can all make your project happen.
I have a few other things too.
Please.
One thing I've learned from my dad is kind of like guerrilla marketing and promotions. And like, don't be humble, it's good to be humble, but don't be self-deprecating. Be really proud of what you're working on and tell everyone about it as often as possible. If you're excited about something, other people will get excited. And there are so many ways to get the word out. So don't be shy.
I'm in about 400 movies, mainly underground movies, to help young people. If I'm in it, the Troma fans will support it. They'll buy the DVDs. And I'm in some big ones like Guardian of the Galaxy and Sharknado and blah, blah, blah. I've written a book called Sell Your Own Damn Movie. And I think the lesson there and what I've observed about young people is many of them feel they're artists and they shouldn't dirty themselves up in, merchants selling the movie and pimping for their films. And they should. Picasso did it. He was a rich man. He also beat up women. Van Gogh didn't do any of that. He cut his ear off and didn't sell a picture except to his brother for $50. And meanwhile, today, Van Gogh is equal to Picasso. Had Van Gogh gone out and promoted, he might not have had to cut his ear off, despite his nose. I've written a... here's a chapter I'm going to present to Liz from my book, Sell Your Own Damn Movie.
Ooh.
It suggests that piracy is good and copyright is abused. Hmm. And you have to think along those lines. You have to share art. Art should be shared. So file sharing and all this stuff that the elites want you to avoid. No, you should share art, and art should be shared. It shouldn't be locked up in copyright for 40 years.
The thread that I pulled from that is to be bold and be daring. And, I love that. I think that's important for everyone to
The commissioner said it. To thine own self be true. Shakespeare, the bard, that's it. Do what you believe in. It's art. And filmmaking, as Lisbeth said, is the hardest. It's the hardest thing in the world, except for maybe opening a restaurant. You're running a restaurant. That looks pretty hard. But you really have to believe in it. And it's... it's just not worth making crap that you think the public wants. Be ahead of the public, and eventually you'll be rewarded. The Museum of Modern Art played the volume one of Return to Newcomb High, and now the Museum of the Moving Image has realized that we've got art in our souls.
Right, so, highbrow institutions.
You have to wait.
Yeah,
wait.
Yeah,
it doesn't
absolutely
happen overnight. You know, James Gunn is the number one director in Los Angeles. Everyone thinks it's overnight.
He
suffered 3 years with us and 12 years in Hollywood. So, he deserves it. And he's extremely talented and a great guy. Great guy.
Seems like a good guy.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream has good people.
Well, we're all melting in here. This does bring up one more question, so I'm going to ask one more. But it seems that all of you have anticipated trends in a certain way throughout your careers. I mean, Lisbeth, you certainly have with Kitsplit. Like, you saw this sharing economy happen. you know, as you mentioned, Lloyd, you were sort of on YouTube early. You've done VR now. You know, Pat, you're the type of initiatives you worked on in this state have been replicated.
So all over, yes.
What advice do you have about that? How do you know what's coming? How do you anticipate what's coming?
I think my dad and both my parents are really good at this, but I think it has to do with being open-minded and keeping your ear to the ground. It's great to listen to people who have PhDs and are super, established, but I think listening to everyone is a lot more, or you can learn a lot from that as well. I also think just like perpetual research and read a lot, which is obvious, but.
And Lloyd often goes against the sort of the flow of the river and does something really alternative and different. Like for when he invented when he came up with the concept of the Toxic Avenger, right? You and your partner, Michael, had just read articles that said that, monsters were dead. And
that's right. Horror Variety had a nice headline.
This back in the early 70s. Yeah, and that you couldn't, and the belief and the conventional wisdom was you couldn't mix comedy and horror.
That's right.
And
you can't mix sex and comedy either.
Yeah.
Because the Raincoat crowd wants to take it
very
seriously.
Which is amazing because sex is so funny.
Well, it's funny.
And Lloyd and Michael were the first to do film sexy comedies like Squeeze Play and Waitress. And then right after they did a series of sexy comedies that did very well, then suddenly Hollywood did Porky's, right? And suddenly Hollywood took. But they were first. The Lloyd and his partner were first, and then they decided to go against conventional
wisdom.
Except
the big companies were playing unfair. They were using good actors and good scripts. So we had to turn to the Toxic Avenger, and we mixed in horror, comedy, sexy stuff, political, police, romance, songs. We were Cuisinart of genres, and when there were 1,500 video stores with trauma sections. We weren't put in the horror department. We were trauma. So it's very interesting. We got about 1,000
But
movies.
I think part of the lesson there is they were completely willing, if not eager, to go against conventional wisdom. And because they went against conventional wisdom and went down their own road, they were literally ahead of the curve on almost everything. And eventually everybody else starts copying them. And then they move on and become ahead of the curve on something else.
And it goes back to what you were saying about like to thine own self be true. Like in today's world, like if you go with your gut, thanks to the internet, you will be able to get connected with all the other people who have similar ideas or get excited about the same thing. I mean, we live in Comic-Con is such a crazy example of this, where I remember you've been going to Comic-Con for like decades. Back in the day, it was sort of a niche thing, and now everyone's excited about it. And thanks to the power of the internet, it's brought all these people together who are excited about it. So if you have a vision and you execute that vision, you can find your audience.
And believe in yourself.
Finally this week, here's a couple of clips from an interview I did back at the New York Film Festival with Ruben Östlund, the director of this year's Swedish foreign film Oscar hopeful, The Square. The Square is an enigmatic pancake of a film that deals with the art world, but it says a lot about the world of film as well. Östlund himself is a film teacher, so he had some great advice to give us in this episode called How to Master the Art of Satire, Ruben Östlund on The Square. Take a listen. It's quite a concept, and there's so many different layers to that sort of feeling about trusting other people, and even with your art, putting this crazy feature out in a world that's sort of, you have this line in the film where these two marketing ad execs come in and they're trying to create a viral video, and they're talking about how audience can't stand more than 15 seconds of a video these days. And then they go out and they lay out these guidelines for what makes a successful viral video. And essentially it's the exact opposite of what you do with your film. You've created a 2.5 hour long film that doesn't really put out this crazy grab in the beginning, but it's more of a slow burner and it gets crazy in the end. So I guess what I want to know is, how do you keep people invested in your film in this crazy ADD world? What are some of your tactics to keep your story and your film engaging in a way that, for me, it seemed like an hour and a half long movie?
Great. Well, I think that one important thing is that you are very interested in you in the scenes and what's going on in front of the camera as a director. And if you are not, then the audience will feel that. Mm-hmm. But I've been working with quite long shots for a long time, you know, and the real-time aspect can build up a certain kind of tension. I don't know, you know, it is being very careful with the details and show the audience that you have been thinking about all the details. I think that Mikkel Haneke was a master in doing this, really, like having quite simple shots that not that much happens, but you are on your toes as an audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm trying to approach the cinema making in a little bit the same way, you know, when you are very, very carefully and planned in what you're shooting, and still you have to have the ability of creating a dynamic in that, you know. Sometimes you have to be very alive and authentic, and sometimes you can go down in phase. So a combination of trying to create the dynamics when it comes to the phase of the film, and also also the image language and things like that. You have to wild, exciting, and sometimes slow and very subtil. And,
yeah.
Is there any way, an individual in even like the film scene can elevate his art to sort of, make the social sphere more conscious of these issues or an issue in general, and what's a way for him to do that?
I think it's about education, of course, and the way that we are looking at the knowledge that we have about ourselves, you know, that we have about ourselves as a species, that we understand that we are a herd animal, and in order to change the possibility to actually, you know, have an decisions that is about these questions have an impact on society, I think that we have to really, really start thinking about, as I said, work as a community. But it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit like that these topics are quite present today, that we realize that this is not possible to continue in this way. To create awareness about this is, of course, big, big, big work, and have to be done in many different levels in the society in order to make people aware of this. But making a film is one way.
Yeah, making a film that's engaging and thought-provoking. So my last question would be, you actually teach film at a university, and we're no film school. And it's not like that we devalue the university process, and I'm sure it's a lot easier for students, prospective film students, to go into the arts in a place like Sweden or in Europe. What do you think the value of that education is, and how can people who aren't exposed to that sort of education replicate it for themselves?
I think that really, seriously, what I really, really think is the biggest advantages of going to a film school is that you can create a network of people around you that are on the same level and that are striving for the same goal and working together. I think that's the most important thing that was for me in film school, that, you know, I met a couple of people that had the same way of thinking what we wanted to do. I met older teachers that now are my friends because we have the same kind of attitude towards what how we look at the world, you know, and to try to build up that network. And, you know, my father's grandfather, he was a mecenate for a group of artists in Sweden called the Halmstad Group. And they were painting surrealistic paintings in like around the 30s, 1930. And he said something that I have always like brought with me. And it was that he said, "You can fight as much as you want, but always stick together." Mm-hmm. Because if you are a couple of people, you become so much stronger than if you are like a lone director or a lone DOP, etc. If you are a group of people and you create your own community, it becomes dangerous immediately, you know. Then it becomes like a movement that is going on. So I think that you really, really should strive for trying to find your group of people and work together and fight and be angry at each other sometimes, but also realize that being generous to each other is only making your own position better and your own position stronger. Mm-hmm. So try to find a group to work together with.
And honesty too, it seems like. honesty can lead to anger maybe or fights, but
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. No, it's really, really great if you have the possibility to being criticized and have, like for me, also now, you know, when you're getting established and you win like a prestigious prize as the Palme d'Or, to have people that have been with you for many, many years and they still will criticize you just as hard as they've always been doing. And don't take the criticism too personal. It's about the film. It's not about you.
Exactly. That's all for this week. Be sure and tune in the next couple weeks for even more of our best advice from 2017. If you like what we've been doing, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever podcast platform you use and give us a 5-star rating, if that happens to be iTunes. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me at @Jim_John_Jim on Twitter, and you can follow No Film School @No Film School. See you next week.